Hi, it's Michael Sanoff with HardToFindSeminars.com. This is the beginning of the Art Hamill Teleseminar, Part 3. We're on evaluating and or determining the value of a business.
As far as evaluating, a lot of people have a lot of different roles they use, but the key thing is, when there's something that is basically in an area of certain net profit, that's what you should be looking for. If you're looking for a certain type of business, you're looking for something $100,000 a year, then look at everything in that category, and what will happen is you'll end up buying a business that's really suited for you, as opposed to something your mommy told you to do. The same thing at one at $500,000 or $1 million. You're going to find anything you're looking for in all size businesses, and you got to go after something that you're going to be happy with, because you're going to spend a lot of time running that company. So find one that you feel good about. Find one that fits you. So start out with that area. Now, the other thing is, when you're going out and you're looking for a business, what you're going to have to do is learn to use market multiples. And again, the multiples work all over the world. And what you're going to find is, if you're going out to get a service business, and taking it as a multiple, I'm not going to use a thing like EBITDA, but we say just cash flow. In other words, how much cash flow is it making? And so what's going to happen is, if you're going after a service business, those are the ones that you can actually get for the best price. And the reason for that is, they're riskier businesses. There's a higher failure rate in service business. Those multiples are normally in the range of anywhere from 1 to 3 times the cash flow. When you start to get into retail, they're a little higher. When you get up into distribution, they're a little higher. And then the highest, and again, I'm generalizing now, is somewhere between 4 and 5 times the cash flow. And you'll hear all sorts of other formulas, but I've been doing this for 50-some years, and those are actually the market multiples, no matter where you go on the planet.
So cash flow, for example, X business is profiting $100,000 a year?
Making $100,000 a year.
In net profit?
In net profit.
After taxes or before? Does it matter?
Exactly.
Before taxes, and so the multiple would be 4 or 5 times that at the highest level.
Right. You're going to find someone priced higher than or lower than that. That's fine. But the thing is, in manufacturing, you basically have 2 types. One is, you are a subcontractor, you're building for someone else, and so those prices are closer to 4. When you get into ones where you have your own proprietary products, they're closer to 5. And don't get me wrong, you're going to find some of them out there at 6, 7, 8. What happened is, in all the years we've been doing it, we have held on at 4 to 5. And again, I have worked with tens of thousands of people, and we have held that standard of 4 to 5 times.
What are the key criteria you use to evaluate whether a business is worth buying at all, and then how do you calculate your maximum bid?
First of all, I'm looking at the financials. I'm looking at the last profit and loss and balance sheets for the last 3 years, and maybe this year to date. Okay. And what I'm looking at is, I'm looking for something that has steady growth. And with each year, it's had steady growth in sales and profit. What happens is, if it happens to have a year that falls off, which means it has a peak and valley, what I will do then is, I will ask the seller for the profit and the sales for the last 10 years. Not the profit and loss and balance sheet, just the number and the sales number, and see what peaks and valleys they've had in the last 10 years. And if it's part of that type business, but you have peaks and valleys, we don't buy those. Those are too tough to run. Also, if you have financing and you have investors, you can have years where you don't make enough money to buy your investors, which means you have nothing for you and your family. So follow those rules. And again, you're going to say, I found this great business that has a big valley in it. Don't buy it. Let somebody else buy it. Because what's going to happen is, by you not buying that type of business, you're taking away a problem that you could normally have in a business. And all I'm trying to do with people is get them to avoid all the basic problems that you could have in a business. And if you avoid a lot of the problems that you can have, what's going to happen is, nothing's going to be perfect. You're not going to have a perfect business, but you'll have a business that is a lot more perfect, because there's such a word as more perfect, less imperfect than anything out there. And that's what you're after. If you want a competitive edge, the main competitive edge is, find one that's consistently making money all the time. And secondly, find one that doesn't have a lot of flaws in it. And that's what we're trying to keep people away from. Stay away from the flaws.
Okay. What is the one most important aspect of a business to examine if you're trying to determine if it can succeed as it is without an extra infusion of cash from you after purchase?
Okay, first of all, for the last, I don't know how much point I've been teaching, probably a third of 40, 45 years ago, we have preached one thing. We go after existing businesses. We don't go after turnarounds. If you have an existing business and it's been making a certain amount of money for the last 3 or 4 years, you don't have to put any more money in the company unless you're going to expand the company, because the company has been making a consistent profit. So since you're making a consistent profit, you need to have more money coming in than you have going out. You really don't have to add other money to that business unless you're going to grow it. And again, a lot of times, depending on the business, you can actually grow it out of cash flow. In other words, it'll be enough for you and your family to live on, and it'll be enough to pay any debt you have, and it'll be money left over that you can use to grow that business, and you don't have to put other money in.
I want to buy a manufacturing company. One of your criteria is to buy a business which profits have grown over the last 3 years. With the current business environment, what is the minimal amount of growth in profits should be the baseline?
Okay, just keep in mind, we're not really looking at what the percent should be. Just basically what we're trying to do is get you to buy something that consistently goes up. No. Again, if in the last year it fell off 1 or 2%, we don't worry about that. But normally, say we're making projections and we're doing a pro forma, you know, projecting what the company's going to do in the next 5 years. We're usually using 10% increase in profit every year as an example. In the companies I've owned for the last probably 30, 35 years, my standard has always been 25% increase every year. Again, you're saying, well, how can you get 25% increase in sales and profit? Very simple. I do not run the companies day-to-day. I'm an absentee owner. So what I'm doing is, I'm managing my managers. Now, if I were running those companies day in and day out and taking care of all the big problems that come up in business every day, I wouldn't have time to do this. But again, by being an absentee owner, letting somebody else take care of the day-to-day problems, what happens is, I can then work on increasing the profit sales every year. And we do. We get 25% and above every year. Is it difficult to do? It's easy. I still don't have a lot to do. Most people think, over the years, I've been retired for the last 40, 50 years. I sort of have been.
Well, you said, like in our first question, you said you better choose a business because you're going to be working in it a long time, but then we also talk about finding a manager to run it. So for those people who think that may be a contradiction, distinguish the difference between working in the business a lot and the difference between, you know, having a manager run it. Like, what could one expect as far as time in the location of the business if someone bought one, and how does that differentiate from running it?
Okay, first of all, if you go in to take over a business, a normal business, and you're going to run it yourself, you're probably going to be spending more than 40 hours a week, maybe 60, 70, 80 hours a week would be normal.
And that's without a manager.
And that's without a manager, and you're probably going to be working 6, 7 days a week. Again, there's nothing wrong with that. that in the beginning, to learn the business. But if you're getting involved in the business, and let's say you start in a larger one, maybe it's above what you've owned before, a lot larger than what you've had before, I suggest you leave the management in place, because what's going to happen is if you go in there with lack of experience, you're going to screw it up. So what you do is you leave the existing management in place, and you say, well, the company will not afford a manager. Well, fine. Maybe you ought to find a larger business that makes money after you pay a manager. And again, let me start to tell people a very basic thing. There's nothing wrong with running your business yourself, especially in the beginning when you're first starting. You maybe have a little donut shop. When they start to get larger, what's going to happen is, I always give you an example. What I want you to do is an example when you're getting business. You can buy an enlargement. I always tell people, take a picture of yourself and put it on your desk facing yourself. Then take a picture of your manager and put it next to your picture on the desk facing you. Every year, take another picture of both you and your manager, and you'll notice you're not aging very fast, and your manager is aging faster than hell. You can talk to every person that's ever run a company, and they'll tell you the thing that drives them nuts is the day-to-day problems of running your business, and that's what makes you age.
Yeah, the stress.
You work as an absentee owner, which means overseeing it, whatever title you happen to have. Your life's going to be a lot better. I want to tell you something as an example. I have done both. I have money companies, and for the last 27 years, I have not run those companies, and life is a lot better.
Absolutely, even if you're taking a little less money. The time's more valuable than the money.
Right, well, keep in mind, what you do is you go out and you're going to find companies that make very little money, and you're going to have to run it yourself, because if you hire a manager, you're not going to make enough profit. What you do is you set your standards. If you want to be an absentee owner, go out and find a business that makes the profit you're looking for after you pay a manager and pay all your expenses. I mean, it's very simple.
Okay. What is the most important criteria for determining which is the best type of manufacturing company to purchase?
Well, you know, a lot of people bring this up today because of the recession we have or whatever we have going on. But the thing, most people realize exactly what businesses to go after. If you look out there today, you look out and you're walking through the mall, you'll notice there's a lot of empty stores. Again, there are always empty stores in malls, but the thing is you find a lot of them now. I mean, you find maybe dozens of them. Those are retail stores. Guess what type of business has a high failure rate, not the highest, a higher failure rate when you have a recession like this? Retail. Now, who has higher failure rates than they do? Service businesses. Why? Because it costs a nickel, and you can have an orange crate and four pencils, and all of a sudden you're in the service business. The problem with that is it's the riskiest business. They're the businesses that fail first, and again, it's where you have the most competition, because anybody can get in and compete with you. As soon as you start to get into manufacturing, what you have to realize is it depends on whether you are a subcontractor or you are the person manufacturing the product. Now, if you are a subcontractor and you are building parts for General Motors right now, you are in trouble. But also, as you think about that, do you want to be involved in a parts business and have to work with General Motors every hour and they beat you on the head continually? No, but you already know that. So you avoid those auto companies. You also know the real estate business is up and down every so many years and say, oh, but this company is so great. They're in the cabinet business. They make cabinets for new houses. I said, that's great. What happens if you don't have any new houses going up? Most of you are aware of it just by your being. I mean, as you're out there, you know. Because I talk to people all the time. They keep saying, what kind of business? I said, what have you noticed in the last couple of years? What have you noticed good and bad? And almost everybody has the same feeling. I mean, unless you live under a rock, you know exactly what type of businesses are failing, which ones are not doing well. But again, related to the real estate industry, related to the auto industry, or anything along that line. But again, I always like companies that are in the business manufacturing, that manufacture proprietary products. If I then know that I have good sales ability, or my company has good sales ability, and I'm selling a product, again, not real estate related, but other type products, I make money. What happens when we have a recession? I add more salespeople. I spend more money on advertising. Why? Because I don't want my sales and profit to fall. What happens is everybody I'm competing with holds back, says, oh my God, we have a recession, sales are going to fall. Well, I don't buy that. I'm not running it day to day, but as an outsider, as an absentee owner, I do not buy a fall off in sales or profit. I mean, that's not acceptable to me.
Okay, that's great. Here's a question. I've had only one experience of buying a business, and my business partner and I were badly burned by what we didn't know that we didn't know. We had a blind spot, raw material sources, which our investigation failed to uncover. How do I get confidence again?
First of all, you go back and talk to Mom. Your mother will tell you this is what builds character. I know very few people in business. In fact, I don't think I know any that have not had rough times in business, and maybe they haven't failed, but they've had rough times. And again, rough times many times while you're in business, depends on how old you are. What you have to do is, first of all, when you're going to a business, you just don't walk in cold and say, give me some numbers and stuff like that, or you stand out and look at the building. What you're going to have to do is put together a series of questions and information you get on due diligence. Now, there's a lot of sources on the internet and things like that of due diligence that are very extensive. And when you walk in with that list of what you want for due diligence, it will blow the seller's brains out, and also the accountant, when he or she sees all the information they're going to have to provide. And they'll say, well, I've sold a business before. And the broker will say, I sold business before. I never saw this requirement. Well, fine, you're not dealing with me. Here's my list. Again, on the internet, you can go on a number of different places, and for very little money, they will sell you their due diligence list. A lot of times when you're working with brokers or merger and acquisition people, their companies will actually have these lists. And by list, I don't mean one or two sheets of paper. These things are very extensive. But if you don't use them, buyer beware.
You're going to have blind spots.
Well, you'll still have blind spots. You have to go in there and use this as a guide. And I'll tell you, if you've gone out to buy businesses before and you thought you were doing a good job, and then if you use one of these comprehensive lists that we use for due diligence, it's going to be your mind and say, my God, how did I ever make it in buying a business?
Is that due diligence list a good filtering technique to identify sellers that really aren't serious, because if they're not going to take the time to go through that, or if they're hiding something?
That's a very funny question. This thing will usually people bow on their knees because they're not used to providing that much information. If they really want to sell their business and they know you're a really regular, willing, able buyer, and they know you'll be able to put the funds together to buy their company. If they back out at this time, there's a problem again. You can also find out if on some of the due diligence they don't provide it, or they delay and provide it. Every time there's a delay, what you should do is realize there's something wrong going on. Don't just assume that there's no problem. What you have to do is go in and always assume everything's going to be wrong. Not everything's rosy. Everything's wrong. So go in with a negative attitude. You don't want to go in there with some Pollyanna attitude. So when I go in there, I'm looking for problems. Do I find them? Yes. Do we then resolve them with the seller? Yes. If we don't resolve them, we don't go ahead with it. We don't buy the company. A lot of times that happens.
Art, I've tried to buy a business in the past only to run into a myriad of legal and financial hassles. How do I get around all the BS to determine what a business is really worth and make an offer we both can live with, Rick?
Okay, first of all, one of the hassles everybody runs into on this planet, when you run into merger and acquisition, or you run into especially business brokers, they will actually drive you nuts with the qualification of the things that go through. What you have to do is, like everything else in life, anytime you have a bunch of things in the middle between you and your goal, you're going to have problems with it. What you have to do is figure out ways to get directly to the seller of that business. Again, the easiest way, and the thing I've preached over the years, has been send out letters to these people telling you want to buy your company. How do you find out where the companies are? The legal library. There's directories in there that list the owner's name, the address, the phone number, the email address. Send letters out to them. You're going to say, well, does that work? Well, how do you think the brokers of merger and acquisition people get their listings? Hello?
For more exclusive interviews on business, marketing, advertising, and copywriting, go to Michael Senoff's hardtofindseminars.com.
Now, what happens, though, because of the brokers, the merger and acquisition people, and now the private equity people are sending out letters and sending out emails, I mean, hourly to almost everybody. So what you have to do is you have to have a letter that's simple, just a series of bullets, letting them know, number one, you are a buyer. You know, the brokers have told this owner about all these buyers he or she has. You can say, here, I'm the buyer they've always talked about. Of course, that's being flipped. Again, let them know that you're a buyer of a company. You are not an agent for somebody else. Tell them you do have the money to put the deal together. You do have experience in the business. You do know that business. Again, just bullets. Don't put paragraphs in there because somebody's going to read that. And again, if the letter doesn't work, change it. Oh, very simple. You're going to say, well, isn't there a standard letter? There's no such thing as a standard letter that's going to work. What you have to do is if you can't figure out how to put a letter together to get somebody to call you because they want to sell you the business, you shouldn't be in business. Because how are you going to go out and promote your product or your service if you can't even do that?
Well, we've got a letter that works. It's been tested by a guy named Michael Chin in New York, and he was able to get a 10% response.
Well, that's fantastic, Michael. I was not talking about you. You are an exception, and people should realize this, and you should put this out there also. I have worked with hundreds of thousands of people in the last 50-some years. I used to say tens of thousands. That number is past due now. And I have not met anybody as well organized or as good at what they do as you do. I'm really impressed. I hate to say this about somebody so young.
Thank you, Art. I appreciate this
number.
There you go. Okay, here's another question. Is there a business health shortcut for a buyer with no accounting background to understand the financial statements and what the seller may be obscuring or not? So if someone's looking for a shortcut.
First of all, unless you have gone out and experienced many profit and loss and balance sheets, going to the library or taking a course in accounting is not really going to help you very much. What I suggest you do is find a CPA that you can work with in the beginning on an hourly basis. And while you're going through this, sit down and review them with them or some other person that is knowledgeable business and pay them so much an hour. Now, again, you don't tie them up completely because what happens is you're going to eventually get down to the last couple of weeks on the business and you're going to want to have them go in and do a complete check of the business. But as you're going along with the P&Ls and balance sheet, you need somebody with experience that can look at that document or those documents and see if there's Mickey Mouse involved. Again, once you've done it a while, whether you're a CPA, an accountant, or a bookkeeper, I don't know about a bookkeeper, but all I'm saying is if you've gone through this a number of times, patterns develop. The people that try to cheat you, these sellers that try to cheat you, are not very creative because the average buyer does not know what he's doing. And because of that, these sellers aren't very creative. So once you understand the basic tricks and games are going to play on you, you're not going to have a problem. If you get somebody to help you in the beginning, you're going to say, well, it's going to cost me. It's going to cost you a lot more if you get stuck by somebody.
Okay. Other than past performance, how do you judge the future viability of a business for sale?
Number one, when you go in there as a buyer, the buyer is usually looking at the last 3 or 4 years to judge where they're going on the business, and then just make projections, maybe 10% increase each year. When you're talking to a seller, the seller is going to say, even though I made X number of dollars last year, I'm going to make $14 billion next year because there's a new road project coming through, and you're going to say, this company has nothing to do with roads. Well, do not believe the stuff the seller tells you about this stuff. In other words, if you do believe them, take it with a grain of salt. Because what you're going to see is they're trying to get a higher price. And what you want to do is you want to buy it based on what they did last year or the last couple of years. Again, if there's something really coming up that's really effective and really going to happen, I might add a little more in there. But keep in mind, if you do run into a real problem with that, if you work with your accountant or merger and acquisition person, they will show you how to do a thing called an earnout. And what you do with an earnout is you're basically buying the business based on what the company did last year, and then you and the seller agree to that you're going to give them a certain percent of the increased profit in the next couple of years to cover this big increase the company's going to have. So most of the time, we're usually just buying it based on the last 2 years.
Okay, well, this ties into this question. Is value and potential more important than buying a business you love? So I guess he's saying, do you go for something you really love, or the potential and value of an existing business, what's more important?
Okay, first of all, go out and look at all sorts of businesses in the category you're looking for. That's making X number of dollars, okay? Once you do that, you're going to find a number of businesses that are going to be businesses you like. And I want to say something. There are so many businesses out there that you're going to find that you like. You're going to find in that category there's going to be a number of businesses with fantastic potential. You're going to find a number of businesses with fantastic value. And the reason for that is there are so many businesses out there that you cannot go through all of them in a lifetime. So take your time, check everything out, and you're going to find you will not believe how many businesses are on this planet that are for sale.
Okay. Given the uncertain times, how would one project the past earnings of a business into tomorrow's economy to maximize the probability of picking the right business among millions of choices?
Okay. First of all, use smaller words when you're going out to talk to people. It's just like when you go up to the Fortune 100 business and you say, I'm very smart in business and I want to know what your EBITDA was last year. The average business owner is going to say, huh? What you have to do is go out and look for basic things in business. And again, the key thing always boils down to is how much did it make in the last couple of years? I don't care what the economy is doing. There's going to be people out there that are worried about the thing because you worry too much. You're going to worry about the thing, oh, the times are going to be bad because it's now 2009 or 2010 and the economy has not been good for a couple of years. And then you're going to get to 2010 and you're going to say, oh my God, Iraq is falling apart. What's going to happen to our economy? You're going to worry about all sorts of things. That is crazy. What you have to do is cool it. Go in there, run your business, and as problems come up in the economy, as problems come up in your business, sit back, be cool, and solve the problems. You're not going to run into any problem that will require you to have a background as a rocket scientist, okay? And if you think you are, you're going to be very disappointed by being in business. Nothing comes up that cannot be solved easily. Nothing.
What is the best way to know if a failing business just needs reworking and correcting mistakes to make it a good business?
With an attitude like that, all I can tell you is you are doomed to failure. Because what you're going to find is, once you get out there for a while, you're going to find that instead of going after failed businesses to invest a certain amount of money, you can put the same money into an existing business. Instead of having to turn it around and having negative cash flow and having a big chance of failure, what you're going to have is by taking the same money and put it into an existing business, and you're going to have enough problems day to day with an existing business that's doing well that are going to challenge you enough. You don't need to get into one that you have to turn around. I want to tell you something. If you think you're a turnaround expert and you have not done it with your own money, you have never turned around a business, because I run into people all the time that I'm a turnaround expert. And I said, okay, how many have you done with your money? They said, what's the difference? I always say, that's my point. I mean, if you don't understand the question I just asked you, you just answered it for both of us. Unless a turnaround expert has an expert with his own money, he hasn't turned around a business. And the other thing is, of all these great turnaround experts, how many of them are successful every time? They aren't. You read about it in the paper, this great person turned around this company and did a great job. And then if you follow their career, the next one they dump. What happens is they dump everything they've done. If you go after existing businesses and build a portfolio of good existing companies, you're not going to experience that, especially if you keep every company separate. That way, when you get to the point where you own more than one company and say one company does fail or goes down the tubes, it doesn't take all the rest of them down with them. So don't think of putting a big conglomerate together where everything's in one company. That is called stupid. I think they call that General Motors.
All right. How do you check for hidden debts, liabilities, or litigation, for example, copyright violations and others?
Okay. What you're going to find is in transactions, first you're going to be asking a lot of questions. The other thing is your due diligence is going to be given to the seller of the business. It will be given to the attorney of the business. You're also going to be talking to the CPA for the business. And when you talk to these people, they also are aware of the different things coming up. And if the attorney's on the other side, bypass the thing and they know about a great lawsuit, and they allow their client to put down that there are no pending lawsuits, there are no copyright violations, they're going to have an even bigger lawsuit. All I can tell you is, in all the years I've been doing this, these things have come out. Because what I do is I take the time to ask a lot of questions. When I first go in to talk to the seller, my rule has always been, back to day one, I spend 4 to 5 hours with that seller. We get to know each other, and usually after the second or third hour, it becomes confession time. They may lie to you in the first hour or two, but usually on the average, once you get to the third or fourth hour, I don't care where you're working. I don't care if you're working with the Far East, the Middle East, or all the years I worked in Mexico. All I can tell you is, it ends up coming out as you talk to them and get to know them. Again, I'm not saying some of it doesn't come out when you're doing your due diligence, but you can also forego that, because I've had meetings where in the fourth or fifth hour, I'm getting the key thing to this. I don't want to irritate the seller, but I do get up and say, I'll see you later. And when I call him back in an hour, I tell him, we won't be seeing each other again. Thank you for your concession.
Is there something you say, like when you go visit sellers, that kind of relax? Like you can say, look, you know, I know all businesses aren't perfect, and there's problems in all businesses, and I'm here to solve them. That kind of makes them more relaxed to confess the problems earlier?
I never start off by ever going up with anything like that. All I say is a simple thing. I tell you who I am. In 5 or 10 minutes, I just do that. And they said, why don't you tell me something about your business? How did you get started? Why don't you tell me something about the industry? Why don't you tell me something about your family? Why don't you tell me something about, and so on. What you're doing is you're trying to ask a series of questions that don't require a yes-no answer and get this all to talk. Now, the problem I've had with a lot of people I've been helping over the years and mentoring is trying to get them to keep their mouth shut, because they're very bright, and they want to get in there and tell the seller how bright they are, and I tell them the purpose of the meeting is not to impress the seller with how great you are. It's to find out as much as you can about the business. And so, ask a series of questions, the other party, the seller, will start talking and talking and talking. Again, as with anything else, you're going to find at the end of 3 or 4 hours, the owner of that business are going to think you're the brightest person in the world. Again, that applies to everything. I don't care if you're talking to some rocket scientist. If you use this approach talking to them, that rocket scientist at the end of 5 hours will say, my God, you are an equal rocket scientist. Have you said anything? No. What you're doing is you're trying to ask questions. You're trying to find out about the business. And again, you have to keep your mouth shut, because your purpose there isn't to show up. Your purpose is to find out about the business. So do it and spend the time, and don't go in there and say to the owner, I need 5 hours. Don't ever do that. Go in there and they're going to say, we'll set the meeting up at 9 o'clock. What will happen is it'll be 2 o'clock in the afternoon, and the owner will say, I'm getting hungry. And if he knows that you're real, he's not going to say, let's go to lunch. He's going to say, I'm going to send somebody else the sandwiches. Let's continue. How often have I had the seller tell me, let's end this now? Never. Now, even brokers that are sitting in merger acquisition people, you know, that would normally say, I have to go, I have another appointment. I still haven't had anybody leave. Why? Everybody wants to put the deal together, including you, the buyer.
Okay, great. What are 3 things I have to have in place in order to value companies correctly, purchase them, and then operate them towards a more profitable future? And where can I locate the right people with that expertise to be on my team?
Okay, first of all, in every transaction, you're going to need a CPA, a good one, not a CPA that understands business. Don't go to some CPA that's working for General Motors. You've seen the job that they've done. What you want is a nice CPA who's done a lot of work with smaller businesses, that has experience in that, that's also done audits or checking on sales of businesses. You also want an attorney that is used to putting a business transaction together, not somebody that is an expert in law that has to do with divorces. You want two experts in your court. Now, also, you're going to find out there, although a lot of the business brokers that you have out there, a lot of the merger and acquisition people are a bunch of jerks, you're also going to run into somebody that are very knowledgeable and will be very helpful. Now, the problem is they are the exception rather than the rule. So you're going to have to rely on your attorney or CPA and also other business owners, because what's going to happen is if you're looking at electronics manufacturing companies, you're not going to buy the first one you run into. By the time you buy the electronics manufacturing company say that you want to own, you're going to have to run through a number of them. I can't tell you how smart you're going to be on the P&Ls, the balance sheets, on the business, by the time you get to a number of them. Because if you sit there at 4 or 5 hours at a time and do this over a period of a few weeks or a couple of months, you know how many hours that is? You know how much of an education you get? I mean, you're not going to believe the education you get. I don't care if you've never been in business before. If you just keep your mouth shut, don't ask complicated questions. Just ask them. They'll tell you about it. How do I know this works? We've been doing this a long time. Keep in mind, I was in a seminar business for 15 years, and believe me, when I was teaching, we gave everybody free help at the time until I bought a business. If you think when I was teaching a class, anybody left that class or went out to buy a business that didn't come back and complain, if something I said in the seminar or something I said in person wasn't true, I would get crucified. I wouldn't say that again.
What is the asset a business has that is most commonly overlooked by the seller that could be leveraged to advantage by the buyer? In other words, what is the first place a prospective buyer should look to find a way to increase the value of the business post-purchase? Maybe he's talking marketing assets, things to look for that, you know, or you look at a business, and even though you may be buying it at a good deal, that shows some real promise. I don't know.
Okay, but first of all, when you get involved in a business, you're looking for business that have had growth. And if a business hasn't had growth, and it's been cruising along and not really increasing sales and profit, you may have a problem with it. But the normal businesses that you're going to look at, that you're going to end up buying, usually had growth each year. So what's going to happen is the first thing you have to do is just keep that growth up and not change anything. And the way you do that, again, if somebody's managing that company, you don't interfere. Well, I always try to tell people when I'm working with them, I'm mentoring them, I said, look, we're going to close escrow on Tuesday at 10 o'clock in the morning. I want you and your wife to meet me for lunch. Before you meet me, I want both of you to buy airline tickets to the South Seas, to Fiji, first class. Okay? And then meet me for lunch. As soon as you meet me for lunch, I will explain to you that I have set it up at a fancy resort, and I have both of you checked in at a bridal suite down in Fiji. It's going to be a first-class deal. Now, I have made an appointment for 1 year. That place you're going to be going to has no telephones, and the island you're going to be on has no phones. You're then going to say to me, well, how am I going to contact my business? You're not. Because if I can convince you, I mean, if a manager is going to be running it, and he's been running it before, or she has, he or she, what I want you to realize is, if you don't interfere and you don't go in, the company will continue to succeed. What causes most new owners to fail? They go in and start to use this great knowledge that they don't have. And what they do is they irritate the hell out of the person running the company. So what you have to do is keep your mouth shut. If you're satisfied with the profit and the increased sales that have been going on over the years, you don't interfere. You sort of come in slow, you work on the outside, and that's what you're doing. But also, don't start getting tied into this market. You're a big marketing expert. People say to me, how am I going to analyze the market for my business? I said, how big do you think you are? Do you think you are IBM, the electronics business? I said, if you want to analyze your market, as soon as you get in there, what you do is you pull out the lower drawer on your desk and you stand on it. Now, when you stand on the drawer, you look out there and you'll see your whole market. I mean, how difficult is it to manage the market you're in? I said, it's not going to be very large. I said, every time anybody asks me that, I always have to laugh.
That's funny. Stand on your drawer.
I know, but you never hear it from a person that's already in business.
That's right. Besides cash flow and prior financial performance, what are the top three most important factors you look for in evaluating a potential business acquisition's potential, and how do those factors change if your goal is to buy and hold as opposed to buy and turn in 2 to 5 years?
Okay, first of all, I have never bought a company to turn it in 2 to 5 years. I don't even know what the experience is. Again, if I ever flip them or do anything like that, that's never a consideration. If anything happens at the end of 5 years, if I have investors in there, and the investors will usually leave at the end of 5. But if I have another deal, and again, I've had the investors for 35 years, if I have another deal going at the end of 5 years, they all end up staying. They just don't want to stay in the same business. I forgot where I was going.
All right, so maybe he was referring, because he's maybe heard something about the investors will only stay on for 2 to 5 years and then they get out. So what does he do in that case? How does he analyze it based on that if he knows the investors want out in 5 years?
Okay, well, the investors stay 5 years, and what we're going to do is cash them out. Now, normally, if you're going to increase your business at a certain level, your business will probably be worth twice, maybe three times what it was worth when you went in. So what you're going to find is you're not going to have a hard time cashing out the investors. Because if you bring investors in on the deals that we work on, you normally don't have any debt because you need X number of dollars. You're bringing in that many investors to give you that much money plus the working capital you need and things like that. So what you're going to find is the business you have is free and clear. So once you get down to the point, say it's 5 years, and let's say you have a manufacturing company, you're going to have assets, you're going to have equipment, you're going to have inventory, you're going to have accounts receivable. Plus, also, you can bring other investors in. Because what's going to happen is, just like you're going through the 5 years, you're going to say, suppose I need an extra X number of dollars. Do I give you a call, Art? I said, no, you don't have to call me. Why don't you just talk to the investors you already have? You know, we didn't take their last dollar. We got them to invest it. They just took a percentage of what they had. Most of them already own mostly manufacturing companies. So you're going to find it's not a problem. Now, I always get this, not always, but from a lot of people. They're worried about the end of 5 years. Well, all the people we work with, and myself over 5 years, we have never had a problem at the end of the 5-year period. Now, do we really sell and get out ourselves? We could do that. So if you're running into a situation that was really difficult and you didn't think you could cash them out, then sell the business. Well, what you're probably going to do is if you don't want to finance any assets, you may bring investors in to replace the other investors. Once you've had a business for 5 years, I mean, if you were able to get investors to come in with you in the beginning, if you've had 5 successful years, you're not going to have any trouble ever bringing investors in because you're going to have a track record, something like that. So it's not a problem. As far as me getting out, you just keep the business. I have a 15-year moratorium. I taught seminars for 15 years. We were in Mexico for 15 years. In fact, it was only a couple years ago that somebody asked me to put together a history of what I've done in business. But I realized that I've done things for 15 years at a time. I've been in certain type businesses for 15 years. Why 15 years? I don't have any idea. There's some clock in my head. I get bored after 15, maybe, whatever it is. Wife and I, though, have lasted 47 years.
You're listening to an interview on Michael Senoff's hardtofindseminars.com. All right. Congratulations. Great.
Well, she's listening, so I better be careful.
All right. Obviously, you'll be interested to buy businesses that already self-operate. How do you know that the business that you will buy is not at the peak of the market and not expandable any longer? How do you increase the value of the business that you have acquired?
Okay. First of all, let me just add something to the thing we just talked about today. I wanted to add it. On the top things you're going to find, you're looking at a business. Not only assets, but financing, things like that, an owner that's good to work with. What you're looking at is a management team. Because the thing that's going to drive that company, it's going to make in the future, is a management team. If you have three owners that have been running the company like I had one time with a print circuit board company in the Midwest and Texas, and I couldn't get any of the three to really stay for any period of time, what happens is if you lose more than two people, it's similar to starting a business from scratch from a risk standpoint. I can tell you that from doing this mathematically many years ago. So what you have to do is you have more than one person leaving, you're going to have to pay them out over so many months or so many years. But the key thing is retaining that management and having good management. And again, if you have somebody this week, you get rid of them. We had Mr. Welsh, who ran General Electric for a number of years, did very well, GE did very well. And you know, when he first got started, he said something that I got irritated about because he had said he had a new plan that he had, which was every year he was going to get rid of the bottom 10% of the people in his companies, worst 10%. I was saying, geez, I've been doing that for years. Now, when you talk to your manager about this, you have to be very careful because your manager may panic when he's thinking about having to get rid of 10% of the people. What I do is work with a manager on an ongoing basis, and we're basically working on phasing people out that are absentee all the time, that bad attitudes, whatever it happens to be. We want people with bad attitudes? No. I'm not in there working on the thing. But all we're doing is we're trying to clean up the company and end up with a lot.
What would you say to someone who's worried about when they make the acquisition of the business and they're worried about their manager taking off? What can one do to make sure that that transaction goes smoothly and you don't scare the manager off and that you're secure in knowing that with the acquisition of the business, you're going to be able to keep that management in place?
Okay. When you have that thing, you have a manager instead of the owner. Number one, that's very good. That's a real plus that the owner of the business is able to put the faith in this manager. What we do is we have a contract. We always put our key people under management contracts. Just keep in mind, when you put this contract together, just keep in mind that it's always going to favor the employee. So if you have to go to court to test this, you're going to find the court will always rule in favor of your employee. Now, the problem you're going to run into is going to scare you, is the owner of the business is not going to want you to talk to the manager. He or she will not want you to even let the word get out because they don't want to lose customers, they don't want to lose employees. So here you're going to get down to the end, and you will not have talked to the manager. And you're going to be within hours of closing, and you're going to say, when do I get to talk to the manager? Now, if the owner tells you that you're not going to talk to the manager until after you close, you have a problem. So you're going to have to figure out some way to solve this problem, to talk to the manager, because you may get in there and talk to the manager an hour before close, and they'll say, I'm leaving.
When you say that the management is under in the contract, explain what that means. And when you write the contract up, what is it saying about the manager?
Okay, first of all, I start off with the letter of intent. The first document we'll put together, the non-binding agreement. If the owner is staying, I will say that we will put together a management agreement before it closes, suitable to both buyers and sellers. We will do the same thing. The managers are not going to know about it, but we'll be talking about the fact of the following five management positions. In the next few weeks, we would like to put together management contracts with each one of the key five people in the company, or three people, whatever it happens to be. Again, the thing you're going to run into is you're going to have to convince the seller that you're going to be a good guy and you're really going to close, because until they get to the point where they know you're going to close on the thing, they have a hard time having you talk to anybody. Say, I'm going to talk to all the employees. That's not going to happen. So what you have to do is reassure the seller, because he's going to be nervous, and if you don't understand it, you will when you sell the company yourself.
Okay, so tell me, what are some things that the seller is thinking? What makes him nervous about that?
If the word gets out that he's selling the company, he's going to worry about losing employees, he's going to worry about losing customers. Both those are the two things that every seller worries about.
I mean, is it a legitimate worry? Does that happen?
Yes, it happens.
Because a new owner comes in and typically tries to screw it up.
Just like these private equities, you know, these subprime mortgages that have all failed. You know, people come to me and said, do we have problems with people coming in to buy a business with very little down? I said, yes. They said, how come we don't read about it? I said, because compared to the real estate market, it's a much bigger problem. And if you don't believe it, every seller you run into, if you're coming in with very little down, you may not want to bring this up. But the thing is, every seller, every investor worries about a buyer coming in with very little down. Because what happens is, if something goes wrong, on the average, that buyer will walk.
And the investors are stuck.
More often than they do in real estate. What's the percentage? I don't have any idea.
Oh, really?
But everybody worries about it. Every investor. So you don't have to bring it up.
So with the management issue, what do you think the best way to handle it is?
Well, what you're going to have to do is reassure the sellers are going along. In other words, keep the seller up to date. Be friends with the seller. Because what's going to happen is, we do not hardball negotiate any time ever with a seller of the business. By the time we get done with our 5 hours, he or she and I are very good friends. We're buddy-buddy. We know each other very well. And we have a tendency to trust each other. When I then bring up a letter of intent, which is non-binding, say the next day or so, I don't put anything in there that we have not discussed or agreed to. I don't play those games. I also don't make the seller nervous as I'm going through the due diligence. They know that I'm checking. They know I'm moving forward. I'm keeping them up to date. They're in the loop, and they're part of the deal. And they know that if they close the escrow, they're going to get all this money, which makes them very happy. But you just have to keep reassuring them that the thing is going to close. Everything's going well, and they will get all their money at the close.
All right, let's go back to this question. I think we skipped it, or we didn't answer it. I'm not sure. Okay, how do you know that the business you will buy is not at the peak of the market or not expandable any longer? Let's say it's been producing steady growth for the last 3, 4, 5 years, but how do we know that next year?
Back to the same market standing on the desk drawer. You're not going to be in a business that is that limited. You're going to go out and say you're doing $1 million a year in sales. And you're going to find that you're in a $1 billion market, or you're doing $5 million a year, and you're in a $20 billion market, or you're in a $100 billion market. I can't imagine what's going to keep you from expanding in that market if you go out and keep running your business. Now, if this does come up, in all the years I've been doing it, it hasn't come up with me. And it hasn't come up with the thousands of people I've worked with. But again, let's go back to a basic thing that I mentioned today, and that is when I was teaching, what I always did when we first started teaching, I had everybody in the class take out a sheet of paper and write down all the reasons they could not succeed in business, all the things they worried about that would keep them from succeeding after the seminar, or anything they ever heard that was going to destroy what they were going to do. They just put it down. I would say, okay, fold it up, now when it's done, put it in your pocket. When you get home, put it in your desk drawer, or put it in your safe deposit box. As soon as you buy a business and you close escrow and you've got all the money yourself, that's your money in that business, I want you to take out that sheet of paper. I want you to look at all the things you wrote down. If there's anything on there, now remember all the people we had go through our program. If you see anything on there that comes up, I want you to call the office and let us know so we can change the program. There is one thing that does come up. And all the people, in all the years, you know, these people ever called us, you know, these people ever told me that something came up. None. Zero. Zip. It's all a bunch of crap. You keep following the media. You read the newspapers. It's all a bunch of crap. That's what people are cutting back on the reading of the newspapers because it's not worth reading. And that's why they don't have a lot of confidence in what's happening in Washington or Sacramento. Again, talking about crap. Just keep that in mind. And the other thing is keep a positive attitude, because if you're one of these persons that worries all the time, worries about everything, or it's the end of the world, you should remind me of that cartoon that was popular back when I was young, before all of you were listening. This guy used to walk around with a metal shield on his head. I don't know if you remember that cartoon. It may still be out there. The reason they did this, in case a meteor came along and fell on him.
Oh, that's funny.
But the thing is, that's what people worry about. Again, quit worrying about all these things. These things are not going to happen to you.
You're listening to an exclusive interview found on Michael Senoff's HardToFindSeminars.com. That's the end of R. Campbell Fellow Seminar Part 3. Please continue to Part 4.